All right, well, you are all brave, right? That's how I start out this presentation. You are all brave. Because it's a very intimidating sentence. When I was writing that book has been out for a number of years now, but when I was writing the book, I had a friend that came up to me and she said, okay, I hear you're writing a new book, what's it called? And I said, oh, What Children Learn from Their Parents' Marriage. And she went pale and she said, I don't want to know. So I think that many of the people that aren't here, because it's a very scary thought. You know, so first of all, you get your mind wrapped around a very scary thought. Like, I knew it was hard to be a parent, but now I am informing all of their intimate relations for the rest of their life. It's a terrible responsibility. And if you've never thought about your own marriage and what the kids might be picking up, it's very scary. So then you think about it and you say, okay, I can handle this. What Children Learn from Their Parents' Marriage. And then you say, she wrote a whole book. What's she going to say? That the kids watch you, and then that affects them, and that's the whole book? So I'm here to say that there's a little bit more than that, and I've given you a handout so we can kind of go through some of it together. So let me start off by saying, how do we know that children learn, and how do they learn? And some different ways that you can kind of, this is sort of the theory part. I don't know how many of you have degrees in either psychology or social work or psychiatry. No one? Yeah, we know. Little hands. Or studied psychology or was interested in that in college? No? A few more hands. Okay. So what we have here is one thing that's called social learning theory. Now, in social learning theory, this was Alfred Bandura was the psychologist. And here's the experiment. They had a room full of toys. And the normal kids, the kids who were not a part of the research, just went in and they played with the toys. There were a whole lot of toys in this room. One of them is a Bobo doll. That's, you inflate this doll. It stands about 3.5 feet high, and if you punch him, he moves around. Bobo. So, but the experiment was, they had another group of children, and before they were led into the toy room, they were told to sit down, and they watched a video. Now, the video, none of them were in it. The video was of another group of kids in that toy room. Right? And the kids were playing, and then one kid picks up the Bobo doll and smacks him. And a very stern psychologist goes rushing over and starts screaming at the kid, don't you touch that toy. That is not for us to be playing tonight, and don't you touch him again. No other explanations, no other words. The tape is over, and the kids go into the room. Right? And that's the same room that they just saw the video, and all the same toys. How many of the kids go over and play with Bobo? No one, except there's always one parent that when I meet, they go, you don't know my daughter, right? But the idea is you don't have to do it. You can watch someone else do it, and you learn from them. And that's one of the ways that we think about marriages, too, intimacy, that children are watching, and they're learning, and they're coming to all kinds of conclusions. They don't have to be living it, but they're observing it. Another thing that we're talking about now, and this is from more of the psychology, from psychoanalysis, is something called identification and disidentification. And these things are relevant to kids of all ages, and they're true for us, right? The idea here is that identification happens when we start emulating a characteristic or a personality trait of our parent, and after a while, we're not consciously aware that we're imitating them. Right? And if someone goes, did you notice that you walk the same way as your father? Right? You don't. Or someone will say, you know, you laugh just like your mother. And you go, she laughs like me. Right? But so you're not consciously imitating, but after a while you acquire it. So that's easy. But, you know, it's a source of strength and comfort when we think about the parts of our parents, especially as we get older. Parts of our parents that we love and the parts of their marriage that we respected and admired, but those are the things that we often can hold if we think about them. But there's another part of it, and that's the part that we disidentify. All of us, most of us anyway, have experienced parts of our parents as individuals and parts of their marriages that made us cringe. And this time it's conscious. It's not an unconscious. It's a conscious decision. I will never, ever, ever be like that. I will never, ever, ever do that. And you think, okay, well, that's good. What they were witnessing was terrible, and they're vowing that they're never going to do it, isn't that a good thing?
And I'm going to say, no, it isn't really a good thing. Because the wish to not be like someone can be so strong and so powerful that it locks you into something that's not natural. And I'll give you some examples. They called me, she was crying, she was pretty sure that he was having an affair, and they came in, and he said he wasn't having the affair, and then she's actually his mistress had called her, so, you know, she was giving me information, and finally said, yes, I did. And so she was crying, and she said, you know, I thought we had the perfect marriage. I mean, it's enough that all of our friends say, you know, that they think that we have the perfect marriage, but I was happy. I am in love with you, and I was happy. How could all of this be happening, and I was not aware of it? Why were you not happy? And he said, no, I'm not happy. Well, why are you not happy? Your sister has the key to our house. She said, my sister has the key? We discussed this. Yeah, I said I didn't want her to have the key to the house. And she said, yeah, but, you know, it was... She doesn't come over except when we're away, when I say please water the plants because we're away, or in case there was an emergency and we got locked out. That's the only reason. He said, but you asked me, and I told you I didn't want her to have the key. She said, so you're having an affair and you want a divorce because my sister has the key? Is there anything else? And he said, well, yeah, I didn't want a third child. She said, we talked about that. You said you were worried about expenses and college costs, and I said I was going to go back to work. He said, yeah, but I said I didn't want a third child. So I said, you know, it sounds like, you know, when the two of you are disagreeing, that she says she wants it this way, and you say that you don't. And then you give up. It's like you don't, she believes that she's talked you into changing your mind because you don't say anything else. Right? Now, just out of curiosity, because this is how I work, because this is what I believe, I said, can you tell me a little bit about your parents' marriage? And he said, barracudas. So they hated each other. One of them was having a nice, relaxed moment, and the other one walks into the room, and you can see them stiffen and get tight. They could be together in the same room for maybe 35 seconds before they would start fighting. It was always like that. They were always fighting, putting each other down. It was barracudas. So you see how the example works here of identification? That this is a man who said, and I asked him, I said, it sounds like that was very difficult for you, growing up with him and watching them attack each other like that. And he said, yeah. And I said, maybe you vowed that that was not what to do in a marriage. And he said, yeah, I vowed. I would never, ever, ever be like that in a marriage. But you see how that locks him into something opposite? So that's an example of not identification, but something that we call disidentification. But clearly, that didn't come out of nowhere, right? So when people end up relating to someone, how they relate in their marriage is very often informed either through identification or through disidentification of what they grew up with. So things that you're doing in your marriage, and we're going to go through them, affect your kids. The final one is something called schemas. And what schemas are beliefs. So all that means is it's like a roadmap. When you have to decide that you're going to, you know, go somewhere, or that this is a lecture, and this is what's appropriate, right? You're informed by something. What? Your previous experience. So we have our experiences, and they inform us. Now, the early experiences about intimacy, this is the theory, the earliest experiences about intimacy, once again, aren't necessarily what you give your child. We all think, oh, I'm the best parent. The one-on-one time is amazing. And it is. That is important. But the schema about what is adult intimacy in terms of what they will expect is built upon what they see. It's a belief system and conclusions that they come to. So it's very, that those are the three theories. And so now I say, so she did write a book, right? So she had all these ideas then that the children really did learn and at different ages. And it's interesting that this talk tonight is happening to your children who are about to experiment with their own intimacy, right? So we've protected our kids, we've raised them, they've had all kinds of peer relationships. And so some of you, they're just starting middle school and you think, oh, please, not yet, you know? But how many of you have watched them at the bar mitzvahs, right?
right? They're watching each other. They're starting to become very aware of each other. And through high school, they, you know, this is the time when your children are actually going to start out and tentatively begin to form the relationships of their own intimacy. So, all right. So what then am I going to ask you to think about? And tonight, if you hear something that you're doing well, you go, yay, you're doing well, like that's great. And if there's something that you think about, gee, I never really thought about that, maybe we ought to be talking about that or doing it differently. The good news is that all of these things, whether it's a schema or an identification or social learning, all of it means that it's open to change, that children can learn, and they do, and they've done all kinds of studies about kids in college even. So as they're, and children are able to sort of like say, well, at the beginning, my parents were kind of like this. And I don't know. They went out one night, it was somewhere around Christmas, and after that, it was really different. So, but they remember it, and so they're informed by both. All right, the priority of relationships, and this is something that the parents of young children find more interesting. You guys probably know all of this, but it will be interesting for you to read yourself. They've done studies on marital satisfaction. Right? So they ask people, how happy are you? That's a simple question. How happy are you? And when a couple gets engaged, they get married, and before children, they're up here. They're loving each other. They're working things out. I'm not saying there's not fights, but they're really, really good about who they are to each other. And then they have the first child. And here's what happens. First, hers falls. And it's not the V-shaped theory. It's a U. She was happy, and then they had the first child, and boom, it's down at the bottom. And a few months later, and this is a trend that will follow them for many years, a few months later, he finally realizes it, and his drops too. And then for many years, most couples travel on the U, right? They thought, and then, just as it didn't go up, didn't go down like a V, it goes up too. They find each other again. And you were going to say to me, when? Right? When? Why is that happening? What is it? Now, this doesn't mean that having children isn't a joy. Having children is a wonderful joy. But how does it change a marriage? That's the question. And one of the things that happens is the priority of the marriage shifts. The priority of the marriage shifts. Instead of being focused on yourself, your family, and your life together, your job, whatever, what happens when you have children? Everything changes. The priority of the marriage shifts. And this is how I know I've got a couple in trouble. She'll come in, they'll come in together, and she'll say, I have four children. Three are under the age of 12, and one of them is sitting right here. Okay. Then, it's his turn. And so here's what he says. He goes, I admire my wife. I think she's an excellent mother. We have three children, and I think she's excellent. She's got the kids. She's got her mother. She's very good to my family. And she's involved in the community. She's absolutely wonderful. You know, on top of that, she has a part-time job. Oh, was I on that list? So that's what happens. You have the children, and it goes like that. Not that your personal happiness necessarily is, although probably it does to some extent, but the marital relationship changes. And then I get women that say, you know, we had our time together. He just needs to grow up. It's not all about him. And I say, you're wrong. You're wrong. Because people don't stop needing to be nurtured and nourished. This is probably made up, but I was told that the idea of a honeymoon, came from two Native Americans who went out and they stayed under the moon for 1 month and they lived off of honey. And they fed each other. Here, honey, you have a little honey. Okay, honey, you have a little honey too, right? And they did that for a month. I don't think that's true, but this is what I was told. But the idea about nourishing, right? And when you see a couple that are just newly connected, don't they talk baby talk? Oh, honey, they talk baby talk sometimes. It shouldn't stop. It really shouldn't stop. People don't stop needing to be nourished and noticed and cared about. And here's what happens if you don't believe you have that in a marriage. You recognize that no one else is looking out for you. See, marriages don't work that way. Marriages require a tremendous amount of sacrifice. Tremendous amount of sacrifice. Is there anybody in the room who doesn't know that? That you have to sacrifice a whole lot to make a marriage work? You have to. And you'll do that if two things. Number one, you believe it's appreciated. And number two, you believe that it would be reciprocated. It's easy to give under those two conditions. But when you don't believe it's being appreciated and you don't think that it's going to be reciprocated, everything shifts and you start taking care of yourself. You know what? That's not good. That's not good for a marriage. And children that grow up, they know this. Because you can say to them, what's the most important thing to your mother? What's the most important thing to your father? And you ask yourself, if someone did that, and they asked your child, now you're worried, right? You're going to echo up and ask the child, tell your children to leave, or you protect them against me, the lady with the yellow sweater, do not talk to her if she has a question. But if you were to ask, right, your children, what is the most important thing? Would the partner be on the list? Would your child say, you know what makes my father happy? Would he be saying, my mother? Is she anywhere on that list? That's the marriage and the belief that we're creating for our children. As they're learning about intimacy. What is intimacy? What is marriage? Is marriage a place where people continue to believe and value each other and nourish each other? Or is marriage a place where people have other things that make them happy? This is just the first thing, right? I better hurry up because we're going to have a chance to choose. But it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting idea. All right, so I'm not going to get through all of these. We want to talk a little bit, right, and ask questions. So I'll just go through a few. I'm not going to go through all of them. I'll tell you what I'll go through. I'll go through respect, because I think that's really important. So respect. The idea here is that, and I'm going to give you a real case scenario so you'll see how important this is, that you children are learning who is respected in a marriage, but they're also identifying. Now, this gets really tricky because this is your kids and their ages, right? So a little girl is her mother's daughter and her father's daughter, but it's gender specific. Now, here's I'll just tell you a case that I work with. So I'm working with this woman. She's in her 30s. I think she's lovely. And she can't date. She's in Chicago, so you don't have to worry that you know her. So she's in Chicago, and she just can't connect with anybody that she's been introduced to. And her friends, she meets somebody, and because her friends, I don't know who made that connection for her, but she behaves very badly, and it gets back to everybody that she was really rude and ignorant. She actually got drunk and threw up. I mean, it was not pretty. And her friend said, you need to be in therapy. I mean, this is just ridiculous. So she came in and she said, you know, everybody else that I grew up with, all my friends, they're all either engaged, married, or they've got two or three kids already. And I said, you're okay, well, tell me a little bit about your parents' marriage. Right? So you know how I work. Tell me a little bit about your parents' marriage. So she started telling me about her father. He was great, and he was talented, and he was a funny man. He was a successful businessman. He was well-respected in the community. He was very bright. Every time I asked her, well, and what about your mother? She'd say, and my father, he did this, and he was really wonderful, and my father did this. And I said, you know, I don't know what happened between you and your mother, but I really do think that you're not telling me anything about her. And he said, because she is a waste. My mother is a complete waste of a human being. People walk into my apartment, and I have a picture on the mantle of my father in his arms around a woman, and they think that's my mother, and they say, oh, what an attractive couple your parents are. But that's not my mother. I don't have a picture of my mother in my apartment. That was the lady of me when they were at a party. And I said, you know, I have heard many things, and so I am needing to know what your mother did to you, and we don't have to talk about it a lot, but I do feel that, you know, part of the difficulty you're having may be about who she is and what she did to you, and so I need to know. But she said, my mother didn't do anything to me. I told you she was a waste of a human being. My father married below her. She was boring. She was a waste. All right. So I said, can you give me an example of what your mother did, but just so that I get an idea of how stupid she was? So she said, well, my father bought her a grand piano, and she took it back. And she bought is it called a Wurlitzer? You know, the kind that you crank them up or you push a button and then they play them, a self-playing piano. I said, oh, how old were you in that? She said, 11. And I'm thinking to myself, I know kids. What 11-year-old wouldn't think this is the coolest thing in the world to get one of these pianos, right? You invite all your friends over, you tell them to sit over there, then you sit down, you crank it up, they don't know that it's that, and then you play like you're this genius. Then everybody else thinks it's so cool, they all want to come to your house and play the piano, right? Suddenly you're a big hit. What kid wouldn't think that this is like really super cool? Doesn't exist. But what was I looking at? What was I looking at? I was looking at the child's vision of the mother through the father's eyes. And so if I ask the question, what did you learn from your parents' marriage, right? The answer was, I learned that women can't be respected. I learned that only one person can be good. And then I helped her connect the dots. Have any of you connected the dots? I said to her, okay, what, this guy that you met, right? Everyone thought that he was like a perfect husband for you. What would have happened if you would have had a nice night with him and he hadn't done what you did? And she said, well, I said, you know, you might have had a second date, you might have had a third date, you might have gotten married. So tell me exactly what you were feeling like before you started to drink. And she said, I felt dead. I felt dead inside. I felt dead. Anybody connecting the dots? You see, if it had worked, if she had agreed to get married, what would have happened to her? She would have become her mother. Isn't that awful? Isn't that a terrible thing? Without understanding the power of that belief, her belief that in marriage women are reduced to nothing, that women have no place to be creative or appreciated or respected, that's what marriage does to women. It kills them. And so she wouldn't allow herself to be killed. She's okay now. She has 7 kids. But the point is that it was about what she learned growing up, and she never challenged it. Your kids don't challenge this. We don't have everyday conversations about this. Maybe we should, but... So what am I going to tell you? There's certain things now that I'm going to hope that you can sort of think about. I mean, we can talk a little bit more about conflict, the right ways to fight. I don't know what interests you. I gave you a sheet, and we've got a little bit more time, not too much more time. Should we talk a little bit about conflict or the positives? Conflict, yes? Something else?
Yeah.
Conflict, yes? Right. So you're coming here. Oh, you see, they were taking me over there. They're all going to be very annoyed because no one else is going to be able to hear this. All right. So here you come tonight, and I told you already we were worrying about whether our marriage is a priority, and that we're very nervous about respect and whether, because the respect works both ways, by the way, because I worked with men in families where the man wasn't respected. Oh boy, does that ever create problems for a son? And the same thing if you're working for the daughter, because if a man isn't respected, and what does that do for the daughter and her expectations about who men are and what she should hope for in her own marriage? Right? So it is gender specific. But let's just do conflict for a few minutes, and then you can ask me some questions. So you think you came here, and what am I going to say about fighting? You should fight or you shouldn't fight? You should fight. That's right. You should fight. You knew that. That was a setup, right? But you should fight. But there's right ways to fight. Did you know that? There's a constructive way to fight, and then there's a terrible way to fight. So fighting is just a statement of difference. When I was writing this book, I had the chapter before was on negotiation, and then this chapter was on conflict, and my editor kept on sending it back saying it's the same thing. And I said, no, there's a chapter on negotiation and how people negotiate, and then there's a chapter on conflict. She said, no, they're the same. And I said, oh, I know what kind of marriage your parents had. You know, because they're not the same. Because negotiating, right, is a statement of difference. We are not the same. And that, I said to the people I was talking to before, that's good. It's really good that you and your partner aren't the same. That allows one of you to be an expert and a specialist in perhaps one area, and your partner can balance it. It's very good. Sometimes we over-specialize, and then maybe that's not so good. But in general, the idea of allowing difference to create yet a new solution or to see a different perspective is a good thing. And yet people don't realize that because they're caught up in right or wrong. I'm right or you're wrong. The nicest thing about having someone else that you can discuss things with
with, is that if you do it their way and it doesn't work out, you don't have to blame yourself, right? But the better way is when you realize there's more than one way to look at this. I didn't realize that. I thought my way was the only way. But now that he's or she is opposing this, I can see that there might be something else that I haven't thought about or I haven't considered. And instead of getting on your own kind of platform and being able to kind of hold rigidly that you're right and insist that you're right, the idea of being able to say, why do you think that? Or what are you thinking about that I'm not thinking about? Opens up all kinds of possibilities, and that's really wonderful for children. But it's also really good for couples, you know, when they're able to kind of realize that they don't have to necessarily be on the same page, but yet they're working together on the same page. So they don't have to be on the same sentence, but as long as they're kind of like balancing each other in a respectful way, it's a good, you know, it's a good thing. Conflict is about when you need to really, you're very upset, you're very disturbed, and there's things that you need to get out because either feelings have been offended. So the idea about a constructive conflict is that you can do it in a way that doesn't cause damage. And before I was telling people about John Gottman, who is a very interesting person. John Gottman is a rabbi who got a PhD in mathematics before getting a PhD in psychology and specializing in marriage. And when he was teaching, he used to make his students do a mathematical formula for marriages. Can you imagine that? A rabbi with a degree in math, a doctorate in mathematics and a doctorate in psychology as a family therapist. A very interesting guy. So what did he do? He got people that were really terrible fighters, high conflict couples, and he got them all hooked up to electrodes and all this kind of stuff, and he got them fighting, which doesn't take very much. And then he measured, you know, what was going on in their bodies. And what he found was that when you're fighting, and this is the research too on the brain with the amygdala getting excited, when you start fighting with someone, you're sensing danger and you're overreacting, and your amygdala gets you in a state of what John Gottman calls high arousal. So your body is really primed to run or fight. So what they've done is they've done studies on these psych students. This is another study on psych students where they get them into a state of high arousal and they throw numbers on a board and they ask them to memorize them, like just a chain of numbers. And then in another moment, when they're calm, they mellow music and everybody chills for a little bit. They put numbers up. It shouldn't be a surprise to you that when people are in a high agitated state, they can't remember things. When they're calm and lucid and they're able to focus, they do remember. And that's what it's like when people fight in a marriage poorly. Because if they start hammering on the thing and yelling and screaming, and what is it that they're really saying? You don't hear me! Right? Well, if that's the state that they're in, and they're getting all upset, they're guaranteeing that because they're in a state of high arousal, and they're getting their partner all upset, what's the first thing that happens? This is not going to hear. So, he or she, right? So in conflict, then, that's what we don't want to do. What we do want to do is calmly, right? So calmly be able to express difference. But it's not wrong to be different, but it's wrong to attack each other. And it's very interesting because what they did with this stuff was, okay, so we're talking all about marriage? No. They took kids who were matched from parents who were able to learn and to treat each other and to get through their conflicts in a different way, and they measured the kids at that point and 2 years later. And guess what? Without any intervention to the kids, and they never saw psychologists, they never hooked up to the wires, nothing. Their grades, their health, and their social interactions were higher. Right? So in the moment, that made a huge difference. For children to be, and the children being exposed to parents who can argue differently, have differences and fight differently, changed their abilities to do that with their own peers, except not their siblings. With the siblings, it was still brute force, but with their friends. So it's kind of interesting, like in the moment and then in years to come, what you expect is often what you get. So the way I end this, and I think we do want to talk a little bit, is like if I said to you that imagine now that you are now walking your child down the aisle, or you're going to kiss them as they walk down the aisle, and you have one wish to give to that child, right, on the moment before their wedding, and I think many parents feel this way. That wish might be, I hope he or she loves you as much as I do. Right? That wish that your child will be loved and treasured and cared for in the same way that you love them. So if you can take that wish and translate it to your own life and your own time right now, that the chances are that if you think about how you treat your partner right now, from this day forward, that that's the best thing you can do to make that wish come true. Because what your child is exposed to, what they see, the conclusions they come to, will help them choose a partner and conduct themselves in a way that will make that wish come true. How's that? Questions? Where are we going to talk? I mean, this is just sort of like an overview. You can disagree with me, too. I like that. A little good fight off. I'll show you how to model constructive conflict. Yes.
I see so many times where I see couples or families in which the parents or the grandparents have terrible marriage and the kids are very loving, and vice versa. And I see so many cases where I know the grandparents were wonderful and the kids have real, very difficult marriages. So isn't there obviously I know them the way you might know them in therapy, but it seems to be so many, to make the hard and fast guidelines seem almost, belied by the reality of people's lives. And it's very difficult to say that, obviously, we're all better off if parents have wonderful marriages and become role models, and that's a very, basic concept, a very Jewish concept of a role model. But reality is often, things are much more complicated than these,
Did you want to hear that? Right. So, you're right. There's always going to be our life experiences where we're going to meet people and we know the stories about their families. But when they do studies, when they take a look at 4,000 people or 5,000 people, some of the studies that I looked at that I think have been interesting and informative are when they take people that have happy marriages, right? So you say, okay, so if someone's been happily married for 30 years, that's good. If they can isolate and identify what has made their marriage a happy marriage, and the number two and number three thing that came up was, my parents had a happy marriage, and I always expected and wanted that for myself. So sometimes, you can take other sobering statistics, which hopefully may not be affecting your community as much as it is the community at large, but you take a look at children whose parents were divorced, and you look at the statistics, the likelihood of a child coming from a divorced home having the divorce. And so you look at thousands and thousands to get, just averages and statistics. So your statement is true, that having a bad marriage doesn't guarantee that your children are going to have a bad marriage, and vice versa. You can have a very happy marriage, and your child could not. So it's not at all that simple, and there's many other factors. But when they take a look at the big picture, what are some of the things that have influenced people who do have happy marriages comes up, and people who tend to get divorced or get divorced second or third times, that tends to run into the family too. So I'm not wanting to oversimplify it. It would just be, if you take a look at the theories about how people learn, that they can get past that. In the same way that one of the things I like to talk about is, well, what if you came from a marriage that was a bad marriage, and you have some of these beliefs or some of those overt disidentifications? How do people get past that? And of course they do. They should and they can. So it's not an absolute. It's just hopefully an inspirational idea. But you're right. It doesn't mean a guarantee of it. Well, the last thing in the world I want to do is make you feel bad, so I hope I haven't said things that are, making people feel self-doubt, if anything, it's the opposite.
one of the things that, if you want to say the terrible stories that they told you, right, were about disrespect or losing a sense of connection and the importance of the marriage, maybe we should end a little bit about the positives, which is families that are able to be pure. You know, that's a wonderful thing, and also a display of affection. You know, when people speak to each other and affection in their voice, when the children, even though it kind of like weirds them out a little bit, but they can see that there's a lot of affection between their parents, which is not at all the same from the sex. You know, it's a sense of playfulness and respect and delight about being together. Flexibility. You know, some of those things are also things that we model, that when we're trying it, it's an incentive that we're doing it when our children are there too. It's a lovely thing to bring that into your family, but it's also very nice to imagine that your children will start believing that that's the norm. Right? You know, respectful and that they... I'll end this on a mathematical note too. John Gottman is the mathematician rabbi, right? So he did a study, and will you tell me what you think? For every bad thing that you do in a marriage, like you lose it, or you say something you didn't mean to, or you're rude or disrespectful, right? So for every bad thing that you do, how many good things do you have to do? Someone knows. So what some people think is just one. Like you do one good thing and that's... He actually said seven, but it's in that range, and I think five was the acceptable. In other words, start imagining this, that if you know that you're probably going to do one crummy thing in the near future, start thinking about so what counts as a good thing? You know, how good does it have to be? Right? Well, what's good? And some of the things that I said before, when we think about, I say, you know, marriages where you take each other for granted, that's huge. That's absolutely huge. Every time you notice something that your partner is doing well and you mention something about it, then I notice how you read the story. I thought that was really nice. That's a beautiful thing. Or, thank you so much. I know you had a busy day, but you stopped at the drive-thru and I really appreciate that. Thank you. In your mind, you're going, one. Two. But it's true. And even doing those things, I mean, you're not going to make it up, but even being able to remind yourself that if the one thing I'm going to do is to not take my partner for granted, but I'm going to start just mentioning some of the things, do you know that it comes back to you? You know, when I see people that are really burnt out and overburdened and they feel all resentful, often it's because they are taking each other for granted. And just that one little effort, the effort to say, I don't take you for granted, I appreciate what you do, can be huge in changing the mood and really starting to help people really make friends. So you guys burn out? No questions or ideas about this?
So you're saying we could have an affair and do seven nice meal or whatever? It's okay.
That's very bad.
Seven seventy
for that, right? All right. Well, we have the advantage of being close to the food, except they might. No, there's no food out there. So thank you very, very much.